disclosure initiative, and we've got Christie and Hayley to introduce that and get us through it.
So this is agenda paper six, which is about net debt. And the purpose of today's session is for us to get your views on net debt from, you know, user perspective. So to give a sort of background as to where we are at the moment, the disclosure discussion for feedback statement highlighted net debt as a potential net step that the ISB could take with regards to disclosure. And so far we've been considering that as under the amendment to IS1 project under the disclosure initiative. And as part of that project, we're taking a page to the board in October about net debt. Our conclusion in that paper is that net debt disclosure should not be part of that amendment to IS1 project, but instead that it should be looked into as part of the medium-term project for research into IS1, IS7, IS8, and some parts of the financial statement presentation project to, in essence, create a disclosure framework. And there are two main reasons why we got to this conclusion. We think that more research and outreach is needed on the topic of net debt, and secondly, we think that net debt disclosures is outside the scope of that amendment to IS1 project. And so the paper we're taking to the board in October asks them whether they agree with those conclusions. So when we do take that page to the board, we want to convey your views about net debt, and we've set out some questions in the paper, and the first one's on page two. So we want to know, do you agree that net debt disclosures is an important issue that should be considered as part of that medium-term disclosure framework project? Why one?
The answer is net debt is important and we should distinguish it. There's no point in starting to define net debt if you define equity.
I would like to add that I think to me it's more important to define interest bearing liabilities and interest bearing debt than net debt. I think it's much more complicated to establish what is interest bearing on the asset side than what is the interest bearing liability. It's actually about having more information about the debt in the company, also when it comes to maturities and interest costs. So it's a broader, from a broader perspective.
Do you think that net debt is something that we should require to be disclosed in the financial statements, or is it a ratio that's used primarily by analysts and they define it the way they want to and the standard setter should attempt to require or define it? And what is your view on that? Is it something that we should define and require or no?
Yes, definitely. Yes, definitely. And just to give you one example, most of the companies on the Stockholm Exchange present interest-bearing liabilities, at least, because the assets are normally very small, the interest-bearing assets. But one problem remains, and that is whether they have included a pension liability or not. That is very seldom presented. And to me, that has a meaning. So I think it would be helpful to have a clear definition of what should be included in interest-bearing liabilities.
So essentially the debt before you get to the net debt.
Yeah, exactly. The financial assets are much more complicated to establish. Whether some part of cash should be included in the business, or if it actually possible to distribute as a dividend to shareholders, it's a more complicated distinction.
Yeah, not only interest-bearing debt should be defined, but also cash needs to be defined better in this respect. Why are investors interested in net debt? Because they want to add it up, usually, to the market cap and use that as a means for valuation. and they want to, they're interested in what part of the cash could be used for immediate pay down of the debt. And simply just deducting whatever is reported as cash from the straight debt is often giving a too optimistic picture of what part of the cash really is available for repayment of straight debt. There can be numerous limitations. Numerous, I mean, it's almost endless. There can be shareholder agreements in subsidiaries that just do not allow to transfer debt from the sub to the parent. There can be partial ownership, where you lose 30% to an external shareholder before it's available for repayment in the parent. There can be a tax levied before you, a repatriation tax of 30% before you can use that cash to repay the debt. There can be many, many barriers for cash before it actually qualifies to be deducted from debt. So I think we need to, probably we are better off by defining useful straight debt and useful cash separately instead of a measure just a simple deduction of the two, because we can deduct ourselves. I mean, it's two numbers, you deduct one from the other, that's not a problem. It's about what is useful cash and what is useful debt for analysis.
Could that be done by a definition, or could that be done by a good description of either what you've included in the cash element and a good description of any restrictions of substance that restrict when and you can pay that, so distribution.
Well, I think maybe the start point is that you have to assume that it's what would be helpful for analysts is what cash is ultimately available all in the parent company and what part of that cash could be issued potentially as a dividend. So that's and explain the limitations. So take a common equity approach towards the cash, towards the line item cash. And for some companies, this will be very simple. But for many companies, it may prove to be complex. And if it is complex, I think we would want to know that, because that tells us something about liquidity risk, about default risk. Whereas companies with piles of cash suddenly go bankrupt. They say, well, how can we get bankrupt? I mean, the cash is just not available for repayment of short-term debt, whereas you cannot tell it's not not available for repayment of short-term debt at the moment. This is, and it's not only about non-controlling interest. This is way beyond. I know how we're strong on non-controlling interest. It's not only non-controlling interest. It's tax, it's shareholder agreements, other limitations on debt. It could be covenants. It could be a myriad. I think especially credit analysts are very aware of this issue.
I thought we might go there next, Austin.
I think in answer to your question, yes, it is an important issue and you should take it forward for consideration. I worry a little bit about what you mean by medium term and whether that's going to actually turn into long term or not. So I don't have a strong view on whether it's kind of part of this IS 1 or the what you're talking about, IS 7, IS 7, 8 project, but it needs to be done relatively. If it was done relatively soon, it would be, I think, it would be helpful. I think it's to your question about, I think IFRS should have a definition of debt. I think there should be disclosures about it. That's not to say that some management's own definitions of net debt are not useful currently, but I think it would drive a level of consistency and comparability across different companies that would be helpful. And you know, there's nothing to stop companies commenting they look at it internally for management purposes. Martin, just on the point that you raised about cash, I think it's interesting, but I assume that when you're doing this net debt project, you will think about the definitions of the components of net debt. So yeah, definitely, you know, the availability of cash across the group is important. When S&P looks at in the corporate space, at least, certainly on the banks, but in the corporate space, the definition of free cash, I think we're trying to take into account cash that's needed for operating purposes for the next year or so, and then we kind of try and form a view of what actually free cash is, not just the cash that's on the balance sheet, even though that may not be restricted for the reason that you set out one time, but it's certainly part of the net debt project, and if you didn't do that, obviously it's just netting two numbers, that's not helpful.
So we lost track of orders.
Well, very simply, I mean, I think, you know, should you be doing a project on this? Yes, I share Osman's concerns that medium term in the ISB sort of time frame could be quite long. Do you think IFRS should define net debt? Well, I think what we've heard around the table is a clear yes. And again, as Osman says, maybe companies will then sort of supplement that with their own pro forma disclosures. That's fine. That's helpful add-on. So I think that's quite simple, really, and really it's a case of, you know, getting on with this more quickly rather than more slowly. And however you put that in the agenda framework, that seems to me to be the important thing. This is something that's been asked for by users for quite a long time, very, very consistently, and you've really to make some progress.
Do you think it's possible for the board to quickly define net debt, given some of the problems with the definition of what the debt should be raised by Peter, when the board is still struggling to separate liabilities from equity?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think if you wait to define liabilities and equity and the boundary between the two, then you could potentially be there for a very, very long time. I think you can probably come up with a relatively narrow definition of net debt that would be useful, that would probably be something like interest-bearing liabilities sort of set against cash that would be available to pay down those liabilities within X many months rather than years, something like that, would give you a useful number that many companies would be able to show you. That wouldn't include pension deficits, wouldn't include necessarily lease liabilities, both of which could arguably be considered as components of net debt, but it would be a much, much clearer starting point, I think. And that's, in a way, what investors want. And investors will come up with their own definition. So, you know, Martin was saying, we want a number, we just add to market cap to get EV. But actually, that's not something investors really do consistently right at the moment anyway. So I'm not sure that the ISB or indeed with BASB could sort of sort that one out. But you could come up with a much more consistent building block that would get you much further down the track, I think.
I think it's here, actually, for me. Hmm? Oh, you lost before me. You wanted to say something.
I thought we were going to get an autism. Yeah. All I was going to say was I think you should produce a principle if you can, and I recognise the complexity. I don't think you can just come up with a list of these are the things you add up and these are the things you subtract. Looking at it from my personal perspective, working for a regulated financial institution, we've got a lot of cash sitting in lots of regulated entities that we would struggle to get out of those businesses, but it's cash, it's highly liquid, because the regulator tells us that's how they want to hold it. We want to hold our regulatory cash, so, and we know what that is, and we treat it as an operating asset, not as cash. When we look at our cash and liquidity position, we actually also add a fairly sizable chunk of our fixed income portfolio, proprietary fixed income portfolio, as cash. Anything that's shorter dated than 3 months and either JGBs or bunds trades pretty liquidly. And we consider that to be cash, even though it won't meet your definition of cash. Well, it arguably should, because if you define the principle for management around what's available to settle your obligations within 24 hours, we could afford within 2 or 3 days, we could liquidate all of them and have plenty of cash. So you need to be very clear about what you're aiming to to show. I think there isn't an easy answer. I think you're always going to end up with, through the eye, not necessarily through the eyes of management, but that management need to explain within a principle how they've defined it. Interestingly, one of the things that we include in emergency liquidity is our gold position, our physical gold position, because that's the thing that if all other markets are closed, we can always sell our gold. We can settle obligations with gold. So we actually consider that as emergency liquidity too. But we wouldn't necessarily include that in a definition of liquidity. But businesses think about their liquidity and their asset and liability planning holistically, and they need to explain to us how they do it. And it does come down to one number, but the thing that's not helpful in cash flow statements is enormous purchases of short-term investments being a big cash outflow, and the business, if the company then ends up with a massive outflow for the year of cash, if it's sitting there in JGBs, I don't even care that they haven't had negative cash flow in that year. They've just been moving it around where they store their liquidity.
I would prefer to have this as two separate projects, and I think Martin very elegantly described all the problems that you can face trying to define what is the asset that you can distribute to a shareholder, and also yet very well described it. And I think it's much easier to define what is an interest-bearing liability or debt, so to speak. And I think a lot of investors would be helped only by that. I can add an example from the problems with financial assets or liquidity cash, if you like. 10 years ago or so, a large Swedish company was almost bankrupt, so they stopped paying suppliers in December. And of course, they received money from the receivables, so they all went into the cash account. And all the analysts created a net debt. And then the 3rd of January, this I have heard from the people that worked in the company, they paid all the suppliers. So the cash went down. So there are, and also if you have a construction company signing a contract, having the customer to pay in 20% of that contractual sum into the cash account, you have the same problem there. So I think to focus on two projects would help to create the definition of interest-bearing liabilities, liabilities sooner than a definition of net debt.
Two observations which actually tie in to some extent what Peter said. The accounting is not all, but generally analysts do valuations by looking at operating assets, what are the cash flows, earnings that come out of operating assets, and then identify the financing claims to move from the enterprise value to the equity concept. Now, accounting is not organized like that, so when we're discussing equity versus liabilities, but accounting is not organized along operating and financing lines, which is often done in practice. Which means that issues like Peter's raising, if a construction company gets an advance payment from its customers, it's basically get the cash, it's going to recognize the liability. Is that financing? Is that operating? Is that cash available for debt payments? So I think you're going to struggle, and my fear is that the IFRS, the ISP might come up with a definition, but the companies are going to have a different definition, and even the analysts might have a different definition of what net debt means. Now, we've been there. We're already there with different definitions of earnings. So I'm just wondering whether actually trying to get there, even from a practical perspective, your efforts are going to be offset by responses from either companies and analysts because they just don't agree or feel that the company's specific sector activities requires adjustments to that IFRS number.
So are you suggesting that rather than require a disclosure of net debt and define what we mean by net debt, that you think maybe better disclosure around restrictions on cash might be the way to go?
I think that's a road worth pursuing.
Okay.
What do people want to use the net debt number for? It's a silly question, but I think it's worth asking. What are you actually using the number for? And I'll tell you why I'm thinking about this, because we're talking about net debt, but there are a whole bunch of obligations out there that could eat you alive. So if you're thinking from a treasury point of view, because we're talking about cash, if you're thinking about a treasury point of view, what the treasury people are thinking about are inflows and outflows, and if there's something may be a debt, may not be a debt, but it might eat you. In a mining company, one of the things that'll eat you is there's a certain amount of capital you've got to spend every year to replace equipment, and if you don't spend it, it may look like operating expenses, but it's actually capital. If you don't spend it, you're out of business. So I'm just asking, what's the magic of net debt versus a number that like free cash flow or cash flow available or cash against obligations you're going to have to pay? What is the magic of net debt?
Well, I don't think there's any particular magic around net debt, but it's just when you go back to the observation I made about you have operating assets, operating liabilities, you have financing liabilities, financing assets and equity. Operating assets, liabilities generate cash flows. Now, depending on whether the cash is part of your operating assets or part of the financing, you're going to have a different view on returns, cash flows, cost of capital in your valuation approach. So that's why you have to take a view, because if you treat cash as an operating asset, it's going to be interest income, it's going to be part of your EBIT, part of your NOPAT, you're going to take gross debt in your cost of capital calculation. So it's kind of in that whole approach of valuation, you need to have a choice. You need to make a decision, not a choice, you need to make a decision.
But isn't that decision tend to be very much how based on how you want to analyze that company?
It is.
So if they create a net debt number that's done very well, what is the chance that you and I will modify it differently? I'm suggesting maybe it's almost guaranteed. The three of us, well, throw Peter in here too. The three of us may. So it almost becomes the justification almost becomes a starting point.
No, but as I said, I think that particularly if we stick to this engineering company, this construction company, the cash they get in from their clients is that available for repayment of bonds? Probably not. Is it an operating asset? You might claim it's an operating asset because they're going to use it to meet the demands of their customer. The income they're going to generate on the cash, is that part of the operating profit? You could very well defend that. So I agree that for different companies, different sectors, you're going to have a different view, and I think that's what the starting point should be. You're going to have a different view on what are operating assets, operating liabilities, and by consequence, you're going to have a different view on what are financing liabilities and financing assets.
So is it to calculate a financing ratio, or is it to calculate a treasury liquidity that you might have?
In the way I talk about valuation, it's basically the claim that goes to the providers of debt capital. That's why you want to know the number. You want to know what part of the value of the business goes to providers.
So basically there's the operating claims and there's the financing claims, and you want those.
Yes.
So here's maybe a broader question for the ISB. I think you had quite a good illustration of the complexities around net debt. How easy is it for you to start down the path of doing a project which has the label net debt and end up doing something that is getting companies to describe better their interest-bearing liabilities or their restricted cash or some other useful piece of information, or even just to get some way down the path and go, do you know, actually this is just too difficult and the debate is too broad and we're not going to be able to achieve anything useful and just stop? Because I think the risk I see from sort of looking back in history at accounting standards setters is that if you label it net debt and you go down that path, there is a risk that you do end up producing something which is really interesting and completely useless, given what we've just heard. In a sense, echoing Dennis's concerns, I mean, I suspect he's maybe saying, well, maybe don't start. I'm asking the question, I'd quite like you to start, but I worry that you won't be able to stop once you've started. So that's more of a project sort of management, ISB process sort of question. But it seems to me there could be some useful things that could be achieved by such an exercise, maybe it isn't actually ending up with a definition of net debt. I think I started out more optimistic at the beginning, but having heard the debate, perhaps I'm a bit more pessimistic than I was 15 minutes ago.
Concerned that this isn't a clarifying amendment to IS1, this is quite a significant amount of work, and that our proposal to spend a lot more time and research into what is the issue and what we could do to resolve it is warranted. So I think you're right, I think we really need to scope this very clearly, but I don't think we can do that until we've done a lot more of this type of research and really define what is the issue that we want to resolve, and what is perhaps of a range of options, perhaps the most reasonable and the one that we can do in the best time frame. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in outreach and talking and defining the problem before we get to proposing anything specific to the board. And you know, this has come up because people have talked about net debt, and we've been confused exactly what do people mean by net debt and what do they want in terms of a disclosure. And I think we need to really define that down and spend some good time doing this.
Sounds good.
I want to comment on this, but actually Carlos is
I just emphasize what Martin mentioned. I think you from my Fred to experience, if you look at both sides of the balance sheet, I think it's more likely that you get it wrong on the cash side than on the liability side. You usually get lots of information on the liability side, but you don't get much information on the cash side. And during the most recent years, I think the cash repatriation is a huge issue. And taxes on repatriated cash is a huge issue. So you just need more information about it. So I think Martin has called attention to something which hasn't been discussed much. It's a disclosure problem more than a definition problem.
If you value a company using net earnings, the debt or net debt is not really necessary. But if you value a company starting by calculating the enterprise value using EBIT, you skip both interest costs and interest income. Because of that, you need to add the assets and the liabilities that give rise to the interest income and the interest cost below when you calculate the value of equity. And that is the primary object for me when I want to have interest-bearing liabilities. I can get around the financial assets by including the interest income into EBIT, and I don't need to bother about the financial assets. And normally, analysts assume that actually the management or the owners want to distribute the cash to shareholders. I can show you a number of companies on the Swedish exchange that would just give me the finger if I go to the shareholders meeting and telling them to distribute the cash. They want the cash because it's necessary for the business, maybe not now, but later on and so on, because they have 51% voting majority. So I think it is also a dangerous assumption that we do as analysts that we can add this liquidity, this cash, in the proportion 1:1. To the value, but we do, and since we do it, we are interested in having the asset defined and also the liability defined relating to the financial net. That is the primary object.
I'm just going to jump in myself for a second. Sorry. I think some of you phrased the question in terms of information about net debt without getting into some of the detail. We seem to be really focusing on the net debt itself and some information about it, the variety of interest in the cash and the debt side. But I think some of the work that I've done at the FRC has certainly talked about reconciliations of net debt, showing the movements over time, and that's part of the sort of information set, if you will, in terms of understanding how the debt has developed and are there accounting manifestations that are moving the debt number around, but also we did quite a bit of work on the debt disclosure and understanding that profile from a currency standpoint, from an interest rate standpoint, maturity, core amounts not being disclosed because it's not required. So I think there's a whole suite of other information that sometimes I looked at net debt reconciliations to try to answer I look a lot of different places to answer basic questions on debt. And I think that, to me, if we're sort of talking about a sort of broader project, medium term, whatever that is, we probably ought to be talking about those other elements as well. And certainly, I think, Jen, you did sort of touch on the cash element and the sort of connecting net debt reconciliation to cash flows.
Yes. No, that was the point I was going to make.
Yeah.
The single thing that our analysts struggle with the most when they're modelling companies and they're taking historical data and converting them into their model and then and trying to reconcile what's going on in the business, the thing they struggle with the most is reconciling opening to closing net debt on our definition of net debt, because the cash flow movements will explain, you know, debt issued, debt repaid. You'll get the cash, you'll get the FX movement on cash reconciled for you. You don't see any reconciliation on the FX movement on debt. You don't always get debt that's been acquired or sold as part of M&A if it's not individually broken out in the disclosure because it's not material. And, you know, we get some pretty substantial unexplained differences between opening to closing net debt that we just can't work out from the cash flow statement. Some of it, obviously, is finance leases, because we include finance leases in our definition of debt and they don't flow through the cash flow statement. But we almost never are able to reconcile it like for like. Normally we can, when management have defined their own definition of net debt, and they've given a reconciliation net, you're 99% of the way there normally. So what I'd observe is, if you can find some way of saying management need to describe how they manage their own asset and liabilities and how they're going to service their debt and what their net liquidity position is, and reconcile that position from the beginning of the year to the end of the year using the cash flow statement plus any other components, that would be a very useful piece of disclosure for us. The net debt number in itself isn't that helpful because we can add and subtract numbers that are on the balance sheet already.
But what you're saying here is that you want to understand the movement in debt and you want to understand the movement in cash.
Well, we get the movement in cash because we get a cash flow statement, we know what the movement in cash is. It's the movement in debt.
So you want the movement in debt. Why do you want the movement in net debt? Because
what?
That's your it, when you say I'm
well, because
they
because well, because if the day before the year end, they issue a whole load of debt and they've got a whole load of cash, right? That to me has zero impact on the enterprise value of the business. I've got cash and I've got debt, and nets to zero. Yeah.
Do you want their calculation of net debt, or do you just want the elements so that you can calculate it?
I'm going on the basis we're unlikely to get a full roll forward of every balance sheet item.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the ones that we most struggle with to understand the economics of movements in value between stakeholders, the thing we most struggle with reconciling that we find useful is to understand net debt. As I said, there are movements in cash that we think are economically, they're informative for how the business is financing itself, you know, that they're, when they're issuing the debt and they're getting the cash in and how that then gets spent is helpful, but it could be that but it's not that useful at a snapshot in time, whereas the evolution of net debt tends to be more useful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have been requesting this during the last 5 years or so, which is the medium term in the common sense of the word. If you take it the medium term, it will take over 10 years, which is a long term. And it should be minded that in the long term, we will be all dead. So the fundamental program here is that we are discussing the ideal figure of something that we don't have at hand now. So therefore, we don't know, because we don't know the program of the something. So in order to, you know, make this project going on, I think initially we have something. Very, very premature one, primitive one is fine, just do it. just put it on the you know, standard. Then the complaints will come from preparers and users. Then we can, you know, consider starting idea in the midterm, I hope.
I think actually that the companies would believe it's quite helpful to have a definition. As I said, at least in Sweden, most of the companies that I come across present debt because all the analysts uses this separated model calculating the enterprise value and everything. So I think it would be helpful for, I don't think the companies would resist if we require the definition of interest-bearing liabilities or interest-bearing.
That's easier than net.
Yeah, that's definitely easier than net debt. It's a separate issue.
Right.
Yeah.
But I can see problems even coming with that definition, because I remember during, and some of you were involved with the financial statement presentation project where we were trying to accomplish something similar to that, and there was very little agreement about how to treat finance leases, pension liabilities, environmental liabilities, things that are on the balance sheet as discounted amounts. Is that interest? Is it not interest bearing, etc.? Some people thought should be there, others thought no. So I think even saying debt is going to take some time to do, and not everyone is necessarily going to agree once we've resolved it.
Well,
I was just wondering, I know that Dennis can talk, but I was just wondering if we focus more on what Jen had mentioned about what the idea is behind it. So how does management manage assets and liabilities in the liquidity position, and perhaps how do they service debt, what they consider debt, if we gave something in a more broad, this is what we want you to provide to users, this information and a reconciliation beginning to end of year, rather than calling it net debt or interest-bearing liabilities. Try to get to what we're trying to get management to tell us. Some kind of, would that be more helpful? And management ends up telling us what they think that is.
Recognize that it wouldn't be consistently calculated company to company.
But that in itself
would that be valuable as a first step, even if it's a label but different basis of calculation?
Can I think it would make the project feasible. And that's by this. I think there's a big danger in endless discussion. The endless community is divided on what exactly is cash. I mean, that's probably management define cash and provide the reconciliation. Management provide that and provide the reconciliation, and then you can have a discussion and a dialogue on that specific to the sector. For example, the insurance sector may have different. May justly have a different definition than a retailer, whereas part of the cash, maybe like 5% of the cash, always, you know, is physically available in the cash registers. So maybe that would make the whole project extremely completable, which is something to consider as well.
Getting something, getting it moving, seems to be what people are wanting, and to have a starting point which we can then build from.
Especially with interest rates about to go up, and one might start to get much more worried about sustainability of first debt positions in a good old fashioned way in a serious time.
No, it's follow on from Pete's observation that if you do an equity based valuation, the interest cost takes care of the debt, which is true, but also partially true, because if you're a company, you can decide whether you're where you're actually going to present these items. So interest costs for pensions can very well be treated as an operating item. So you're basically moving the discussion on what's debt from the balance sheet to how you present it in the income statement. So I conceptually agree with what you're saying, just you still have to resolve the issue how you define it, because the presentation is subject to discretion.
Management is definitely a problem.
You can move stuff around a lot. Yeah, a lot.
But
But actually, I've made the observation I wouldn't include pensions necessarily in my definition of net debt, even though I can consider it part of my enterprise value. Maybe part of the reason for that is we get a reconciliation of opening to closing pensions anyway. So my, you know, the analysts aren't complaining about that, they don't have visibility about what's going on with that component of the enterprise value.
Yeah, but it also applies to our example of construction companies
yeah,
and how you deal
fair.
With interest.
Anything else
on this?
Any
questions?
Oh, sorry,
Mary, you raised a point just a little earlier about making progress, and you said, you know, if companies were encouraged to make their own disclosure and use their own definitions, that might be a way forward. I think a lot of companies are. Some companies are doing that already, but I think what's needed perhaps is a combination of that process to get it to completion, but also the IFP having some definition out there which companies may choose to adopt, and where they don't, they provide their own definition. Because I think there is some need for driving greater consistency and comparability, which I think is one of the key points of financial statements to begin with. So I think I'm more optimistic than any other table. I think it's funding that. Well, first of all, I think we all agree it needs to be done, but I think it can be done. You're not going to satisfy everyone, but where you have at least some level of starting point comparability, that's extremely helpful for analysts and for users.
But I think Christy noted this earlier when she was recapping the sense around the table, that the work that's necessary to get to definitions or descriptions to drive the comparability could be quite extensive. If taking more AG's point about get started and then have the debates about tuning. Sorry, I'm shorthanding your comments, but it's a reminder that we're all dead in the end, in the long term. The only thing I could see delivering soon, and I question whether it has worked or not, and that's what I was trying to ask, is something that says, you know, Barbara said, this is the objective, to get information about X. Maybe acknowledging that there are different views about exactly how that calculation should be done, but here's the objective, something about how you service the debt and then, you know, the net liquidity. Those were words that Jed used. Here's the objective. Present a calculation. Explain how you determined or derived the amounts of the calculation. And we recognize it will not be consistent company to company, but there is a requirement to make that disclosure. Would you say it's useless if we don't have consistency in the definition?
No,
or would you say there's value even if it's not directly comparable?
I think there's certainly value even if it's not directly comparable. I think the other point, I guess, is if companies are using their own definition, then there should be some mechanism to ensure that definition at least is consistent over time. Within that one company.
That's auditors.
Sorry?
That's the auditors. I mean, if you make a private financial statement, the definition should be audited. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but there's nothing in audit saying you've changed the definition. So if there's a change in definition, I mean, that needs to be made clear as well.
We have general consistency requirements.
A quick suggestion on the disclosure, I think that the US has a rule on this. If they had to disclose debt covenants, that would be very useful, and as part of that, had to disclose, you know, if it's net debt to EBITDA is one of the covenants, what's the definition of net debt in that?
That's something to discuss with the Global Preparedness Forum to get their insights and views on this. And some are.
We have done so to a degree in the last meeting.
We actually had, we asked it from in the media, we asked it in the Netherlands, we had like a 95% follow-up in 2 years from about 20 to 95. So there was a great willingness amongst preparers to provide a definition of the covenants and what the levels were and how they actually performed on those levels.
What you need. I think I need final questions. Okay, anyone else? Okay. Thank you.
well. So we need to think about how to balance the time so we make sure we don't cover enough on that sort for you, but we want to talk about the key accounts and what we want to contribute.
Well, maybe I'll ask you then, or others, or give you the option, by the way, because I did, Barbara let me know that I think I understand already. We kind of had a bit of discussion about sort of providing, how you provide comments or feedback to the NSP generally, and then also, of course, specifically in the context of leases, but that perhaps you wanted to continue that conversation. So I think up to you, if you would want to start to continue that conversation first of all, or if you have any questions for us sort of more generally on the project and on SAE, and then can you talk to us afterwards?
Maybe Katrina, you would start by giving them the summary of what we've heard so far on our outreach. I tried to give them a flavor of that, but I'm not as knowledgeable as you are.
Yeah, but then, by the way, I do say, Patricia, I warn you all, is that when I start to go into far too much detail, then you mustn't please stop me. Yes, no, I do. By the way, I trust the next Jan to do that.
When you start getting out postcodes and response.
You need to become increasingly less subtle in your sort of body language.
We're going to spend a half hour total and then break for lunch.
Okay, perfect. So I will try to keep it high level and leave it to you to ask me more detailed questions. But maybe what you had is that since we spoke to you in June, because obviously we spoke to you in June about lessee accounting, and we had a good debate, I think, with you and the global preparers around the lessee accounting proposals. Since then, we've been out and about having as many meetings, I suppose, as we can, largely with you and others from the investor and analyst community, but also, and that was of course very much focused on assessing benefits, real benefits that would flow from this project, and making changes to lease accounting. And we also, the other piece of our out and about outreach was to try and focus on the cost side as well and speak to preparers. So on that side, first of all, I suppose we have gone and had what we call individual fieldwork meetings with mostly lessees, but also a few lessors. And there the focus was to try and go, you know, to these companies' premises, meet with them individually, spend half a day and longer really trying to get to a level of detail of understanding about the costs of implementation, you know, that you can't really get to, say, in a written comment letter. So far we've had more than 20 of those meetings. I think it's fair to say that clearly at every meeting there are concerns about costs and complexity of the proposals. I think what was useful from those individual meetings was, by the way, that we weren't just talking to the accounting people, we got access to, you know, IT people, investor relations people, legal departments. So we got a more complete picture, and I suppose that around the cost concerns, what was useful was that at each meeting, in understanding much better the sort of lease portfolios that these people had, you can really pinpoint much more clearly what are the specific drivers of the cost for those entities. And so when people have cost concerns, very often you can pinpoint it down to, well, it's that one particular aspect of the proposal that's really driving it specifically, or it's those two particular aspects that's really driving it. It's because they're concerned about how to assess lease term and work out what significant economic incentives, etc. So that's been useful in that respect. And in terms of all the meetings we've had with investors and analysts, we have put a summary of what we heard up until the end of September on our website. At this point, the meetings have continued, so at this stage we've had more than 40 meetings, and we've had about more than 250 investors and analysts, and thanks to some of you who have helped us access some of those investors and analysts who we haven't traditionally been able to speak to. And I suppose the high-level message coming through there is that we feel we do have broad support for the lessee accounting proposals. Credit analysts, I suppose, in particular, you know, credit analysts are generally very supportive of the proposals, perhaps understandably with more of a focus on sort of liabilities commitment side and focus on getting at better information about leverage. The views from the equity analysts are slightly more mixed. obviously on the equity side, some of the equity analysts would prefer to get bigger assets and liabilities on the balance sheet, more of a whole asset type of approach. Some others say that they would prefer to have some sort of an ongoing perpetual commitment as opposed to just being contractual commitments. But we still think overall there's kind of a majority and a general sort of support for moving forward, and that there is really benefit to be achieved, and moving forward with the lessee accounting proposals would really provide investors and analysts with a much better starting point in which to base their analysis. In saying that, not everybody agrees, and I think that's clear in what the FASB's user group, the IAC, have reached a conclusion on. I think again, there for them, it's not that they don't think leases create assets and liabilities. I think in their comment letter, they say they believe a majority of investors and analysts view leases as creating assets and debt-like liabilities. It's just that when they look through, they say because no one amount could ever reflect exactly everyone's views of what leases are, they would prefer a much more extensive disclosure package. We've also had some roundtables. We have public roundtables in September and October, where we had mixed participants and therefore mixed views. So with that, maybe that's high level, sort of an overview of where we are in different pieces of what we've heard so far. And I suppose I'd ask you if you have any particular questions.
Is it fair to say, Katrina, that because of the IAC's position, that we've been hearing more from people who are concerned about the cost, that there is very little benefit for users, and therefore we might consider going in a different direction than like just doing disclosure?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, one of the effects that you can see, and by the way, I should caveat my comments to say we have now got something like 615 comment letters, and I personally have not read all of those as of yet. I am making my way through, but as I make my way through a lot of those comment letters, you do see quite a lot of reference in those comment letters to the views that came out from IAC. And therefore, preparers, even the accounting firms and others, you know, with reference to the public statement that came out from IAC saying, well, is there really benefit? It seems clear there's cost. And either, you know, saying the views of some of the accounting firms, we're not sure whether the benefits outweigh the costs overall. And others saying, well, it's clear given that view that there isn't very much benefit here. We think there's going to be lots of costs, so surely that's evidence that costs do outweigh the benefits and the board should.
Just a quick question about that. If they're going to have to disclose, they're going to incur the costs anyway. So,
yeah.
What, you know, if the only way to save costs is to do nothing.
Well, I think, by the way, Jane, that is part of the conversation that we've been having, you know, with some people. Interesting, just earlier this week, we had a conversation with our advisory council about leases, and then that was one thing that was raised, you know. So, you know, if an alternative for the board was to say, well, okay, we should just work on disclosure, let's not change the actual accounting, at least one of the preparer representatives at the advisory council indicated that she thought, she said, from a preparer perspective, disclosure only is simply not an option for us. From her standpoint, that she felt that would mean still incurring quite a lot of the cost, and then potentially still be open to having to do more change later. And it's part of what we try to do as part of the fieldwork as well is really ask that question. And I think it's my statement that preparers would say that geography doesn't necessarily change costs at all. If you're putting the same output of information in the notes compared to the balance sheet, that doesn't change costs. The only way you change costs is if you change the output. So in some way you make a disclosure and you make the disclosure be something different from what you would have to do if you were putting it on the balance sheet.
Peter?
Is it possible to go forward with a simplified method for the companies where the effect is not that big, because what I have found in my research is that most companies are not affected at all, or very little, but some of the companies are tremendously affected. And what I want is, of course, a detailed presentation, not disclosure, but on the face of the income statement and the balance sheet in those companies where the effects are big, that I can settle with a simplified method for the companies where the effect in comparison to equity is below like 5% of equity or something.
I mean, I think that we definitely have a lot of suggestions, again, by our field work, other meetings, and even in comment letters on various ways that we simplify the proposals. And I think part of the process that we're now going through as staff and the boards will go through is really, you know, looking at that cost side and assessing whether there are ways that we could really reduce, you know, the cost quite significantly based on what preparers say without necessarily losing a huge amount of benefit. And one thing, Peter, that has come up quite often is just where there often can be very high volumes of quite small tickets.
I'm actually quite surprised how the whole discussion on, well, whether is there a benefit, because there's a group of users in the US that disputes or has some second thoughts about the benefits, whereas I think many users would agree that that there are significant benefits. And somehow that message clearly is not the going thought in the standard setting world, that users do see the benefit. And I'm a bit worried that we have a misperception at the moment, and we may explore, maybe we should consider exploring whether the CMEC could play a role in counterbalancing the current misperception about how the analyst community views the benefits of this project.
So we're being inclined to capture that.
I think it seems to me that we've got a very clear majority of users who say we need improvements. That's very, very clear. I've done some sort of investigations amongst our client base, and the feedback we've got from a relatively small sample is that there is a small majority of people who say, yes, absolutely, we want more stuff on balance sheet, more operating leases capitalised in very broad terms. There's probably another quarter of respondents who say, well, that's what we really want, but we'd settle for disclosure. So sort of improve something, don't just do nothing. And then there's a significant but a small, you know, small minority, 25% or so, who seem to be saying in various different ways, look, you know, don't do it. So I think the majority is very much in favour of doing something. I think what it then comes down towards is the cost benefit payoff. And I think at the moment the ISB and the FASB are failing to make the case for that cost-benefit payoff. And if, as I think you're saying, if disclosure only is going to cost as much or nearly as much as putting it on the balance sheet, and at a minimum disclosure only is wanted by, let's say, sort of 70-75% of sort of people, a large majority, then what we're basically saying is a large majority of users want something that is going to cost preparers. So irrespective of what you do to satisfy users, preparers are going to have to suffer a cost. So then what you need to do is you need to do the analysis that you're beginning to do and say, well, is there a way of finessing our requirements a little bit so we cut back on 20 and save them 80? And if you can do that, then you've sorted it. But that's the case that needs to be presented, because I think at the moment, you know, I want to make this sort of feel personal because I don't mean that, but you know, you broadly, meaning the boards and the staff, you are failing to persuade people. There are lots of people around the place who have sort of beliefs, but they don't feel that the argument is being presented persuasively. And I think the cost is a key part of that.
Yeah.
maybe we should have, instead of talking about, my remark was, can we do something as a CMEC? And talking about percentages of 25, 50, I think maybe we can as a CMEC see where the common ground is and say, and provide a counterbalancing statement.
But we still come down to the basic question that if you're going to wipe 10% off the market cap of the world by doing this interesting accounting change, that might be too high a cost. If it's going to be 0.001%,
well, we argue that you'll have less insolvencies because the liabilities will be more visible, and you know. Yeah.
But I think the cost benefit payoff is where the argument now sits.
If you're talking about in terms of 10% decline in market cap for a company based on improved disclosures, probably we need it today instead of tomorrow. All of it.
Let's not use money, but it's the cost. The companies will have to pay real money. We need to identify what is the cost of companies doing that, and then we need to make the case that, yes, it's worth it.
And the benefit is the correct allocation of capital.
So the first thing is just because one U.S. group says settled disclosure, I think it's a huge red herring. What that group says is let's take that one group. They basically said the system's broken. You need a whole bunch of disclosure anyway. What we're hearing is there's a problem. And even the U.S. group says there's a problem. Their solution, by the way, was disclosure, which has the same cost. But I'm not sure how many user groups have said there isn't a problem, but my impression is they've all said there's a problem. And there's a lot of different solutions out there. But I think we're making much too much a big deal about what this one group says, and we're not taking the message that they've said is, it doesn't work. Now, as far as cost-benefit analysis, this is the same old thing we always hear. We have a large percentage of the users that say you need to fix something. We all know that the leasing standard issue has been known for, generations. This is a well-known issue. There's going to be costs with it, and I don't understand why the cost-benefit equation is any different than all the other changes to financial standards. If there ever was a standard that people are saying doesn't work, it's this one. We use the leasing standard as the poster child for why you don't use bright lines in standards. We partner Deloitte said it was the best way of gaming the financial statements was to use leases. I'm shocked that we're even having this conversation. Yes, at the fringes, if we can get 80% of what we want and decrease 80% of the cost of the preparers, by all means, let's do it. But this conversation should not be sidetracked by one group who happens to say disclosure.
Is there a consensus in this group that we should proceed with the project and put the assets and liabilities on the balance sheet? Is that the consensus of this group?
In fairness, does anybody disagree?
Is there anyone that doesn't think we should proceed down the path with our due process and complete this project in its normal course with assets and liabilities on the balance sheet?
So are we getting towards a potential letter from this group which would say that? And it would actually also say, we welcome the fact that IAPS also thinks there's a problem which needs fixing. And I think Peter's very eloquently laid out the fact that we have a vast majority of users who want to see the information and therefore that the preparers will incur the cost. We welcome the fact that the ISB is committed to trying to simplify it to reduce the cost as much as possible. But that this has been a long-standing problem. We are absolutely clear that this is what we want.
It's a fundamental problem that needs to be fixed. Let's be fair, we've all proposed or listened to other alternatives. There was a myriad of alternatives. in the infinite wisdom of the ISB, you guys have settled on one, and this is a case where, honestly, that's your job. You've done your job, you've listened to everybody, you've weighed the pros and cons, and you've basically told us this is, let me say, the least bad of the ones, or the best of the ones, but I think we accept that you've done your work, and this is the one you think is the best, and let's go with it.
Well, I've spent a lot of time together with Katrina and the others in the team here on this project, and I think it's really rewarding to be out meeting a lot of people, and I thank you with those of you who have helped us to see people. I think Peter is very spot on with this, with cost benefit. I think, first of all, that we are heading for a rather ugly fight. We know that important people in Brussels are being lobbied since a long time. We have been talking about all the horrible things that will happen. We have letters from more than a handful of members of US Congress writing to us with, I don't know, 20 questions. Have you considered this and this and this and that? And we have a powerful leasing industry that are worried about the future, and we have the big corporates who are fighting for not showing their things on the balance sheet. We have strong support, people like you. But in the end, we will have that to fend off this resistance. The base for saying that this should happen, there are a lot of really rubbish arguments in my mind. But cost and complexity is there. And with these 20 and a few corporates we have been seeing, we have been out there, we gave them questions in advance, tell us what this means. And we have a couple of cases where people have given very broad answers, or this will cost us 100 million euros or something. And other people have really done the homework and they analyzed and so forth. And we don't really have the cost and the complexity issue ready for an analysis. So we have to do more work on that. I am personally convinced, after having made these roughly 20 meetings with sort of a 3-4 hour session together with IT people, investor relations people, auditors, internal controls, etc., that a lot of exaggerations are done. And we will also take some of the response letters that are critical and go back to these companies and say, you are saying that you have a big cost and complexity. Let us know what we have. And then in the end, we will do changes. We will not do what we have in the exposure doc, we will do adjustments, and that's our job. And in the end, it will be a matter then to say, will we get the backing from those who are important in the world? This will be a test, really. Does the world accept independent standard setting based on logic? Or is it a matter of saying political influence has more value than logic? And I think this will be a real test. If this model for the future will work, or will we have now for, let's call it, political standard setting based on who is sponsoring re-election of people and things like that. So it will be an ugly fight. And I think if the investment community doesn't stand up, I see a problem. I'm doing this. But if we don't get real solid support, there will be people who will have. And we talk about both in Europe and in the US. Very forcefully lobbying organization. They have ways of working that we are not used to.
So a statement from the CMEC would be helpful?
I think, yeah.
Yeah, we've not.
We're not going to give you advice on what you should do.
No.
It's up to you, of course. I think you should have a discussion with your American friends and see why you come to so different conclusions, because I don't understand.
No, maybe an approach as well.
But I think we can talk about why we come to different conclusions. Why, and we can also talk about why some other groups have conclusions are hard to, their conclusions are hard to justify. We've always struggled about whether we as a group should be writing opinions given the environment we have. But in this particular case, we have the user group for the FASB. Is being quoted, I think we should be out there saying, by the way, the other group has a completely different opinion and these are why we have them. I mean, I think it's the only reason not to do it is if the ISB doesn't want our opinion in the public domain, that's fine.
We are live and on air.
we're independent. So actually, I think if we're going to do this, we should. Well, occasionally, we might write a letter saying that they've got it wrong.
Well, I think they've got it wrong. But the other thing is if somebody suggests that this particular group listens to is somehow attached to the ERP or somehow is not independent from the FASB, they just don't know us. We're a stubborn bunch of people. And the fact is, I think one of the things that's interesting about this group is we're a stubborn bunch of people who like to disagree just as a matter of principle. And when we none of us are telling, nobody raised their hand saying, don't go where you're going, which is unusual for us because there's so much.
Yes, thank you. We're putting all the leases on the balance sheet is a long-held dream of the investors at large, and we are at a critical juncture whether we can realize that dream or not. So under circumstances, I agree that we're going to write a letter, although it is a sort of the exceptional for our tradition, but we are at an emergency state. But the question here then, what would be the contents of that letter? If we write in the letter, we still want it because we need it, then that should, I think simply it will be disregarded. Because the issue, as Peter said, for the preparers is a cost. I know you won't. We don't do that because it's too costly. So I think that in order for our letter to get some attention, realistic attention, we should write upon something about the cost. What kind of concession or compromise we can make considering the environment? I have two ideas. One idea is the materiality, which somebody already spoken about. We don't want to see the tiny little company showing all the detailed analysis. Only the big ones show them. The other one is lessor accounting. Some of the Japanese preparers are against this one because of lessor perspectives. And we wrote comment letters, but actually we didn't pay too much attention for lessor side. And I think that the lessor, they have a pretty wide range of lessors, pure ones, concentrated in them. Then we need to have the detailed information that is required in the exposure draft. But for the other one, who are doing that basically as a side business, maybe they can have easier options. So in other words, according to the business models, I think lessors are maybe allowed to use optional accounting and leasing, which is of course against the comparability. But if we force the one same accounting to the pretty much different business models, that's just like comparing the water and oil.
I think you're if you want to capture the hearts and minds of preparers on leases, and be sensitive to the cost, I think we have to stress that ultimately it's the investor. There's these costs because we are the financial stakeholder in the company, and it's us that say we think it's worthwhile. We pay the cost. You pay the bill, but we bear the cost. And I think that's maybe a message we need to get across. And I think I fully agree with your comment on materiality. Materiality is like it applies here as well to water. And we can make a claim. I don't probably going into lessor accounting. I don't think the world's too focused on the cost of the lessor. It's their core business. If there are lessors, there are lessors, and if it's insignificant, it's already covered by the materiality. So I agree on the focus on materiality and say we bear the cost. That's probably a statement we can.
But to make my position a little bit more clearer, when I said about the materiality and resource accounting, these are the sort of the interrelated. So for those companies, for which they are leasing the material businesses, then do what we do, exposure draft say. And for the other companies, maybe we can allow them to use the sort of the operating this type of the accounting that have been required for them before.
I know.
We need to work out how we're going to do this, but it sounds like we've got support for a letter. sounds like we need to very definitely cover the cost issue, and I think your idea of who ultimately bears the cost is quite an important one as well. I suspect we would not come to agreement based on, we discussed this in the last meeting, of type A, type B, and all of that. So I think we must probably leave that aside and just focus on just the initial bits. Is that where we, or do we want to just have 2 minutes now? We have no minutes left on lessor accounting.
I think we have to. What might be useful is somebody's going to have to. A smaller group needs to draft it.
Yeah.
What I suggest is we throw in what we think the key points are that we want. I think one of the things we want to decide is whether we want to only talk about what we all agree on, or do we want to talk about where we disagree.
Yeah.
And I think one of the places that we disagree is that I think all of us, our perfect model, in fact, is different. We all think the perfect model is different. And I think the consensus is if we don't get our model, and I know that you had your model and I have a different one, and I think we all have it, but if we don't get your model, our model, is the ISB model okay? And I think the answer is we actually think it's okay. And maybe that's where the consensus is. But what I suggest is that each of us send to whoever's going to be the scribe, the main scribe, what are the key things we think should be in there. Somebody needs to do a draft, circulate it around, and maybe we need a conference call to discuss some issues that can't be resolved by telephone. But that's the mechanics of how we need to do it. Can't be resolved by emails.
Just a question in terms of process. How useful is it to the IASB when you're counting up letters to have a one-pager that says, we support having operating leases on balance sheet, love the CMAG? Or do you need 14 pages that say, you asked this question, here's our answer? Because I think we can probably agree on a one-pager. If we start getting to five, then it'll actually turn into 25. And
my personal view is it's better to have a short letter, which is more difficult to write. Because this would be read by lots of people. And if it's 40 pages, they will just read the introduction anyhow. So I think the key messages is really that I think we spread through it.
I think it's maybe better to make it not a comment letter, but a letter from this committee to Hans as a result of our
NFSB.
NFSB, right. Because anyway, comment letter did end is already over, and we are writing this based upon the newest information. And then if it is a simple comment letter, it would be buried in the 700 others. So maybe the, of course, can be treated as the one of the comment letters, but not send it to the comment letter in the ISB website, but directly send it.
So more like the French presidency writing about derivatives.
This is you guys. I'm looking at the two of you. You got the prestige of being chairs. Now you have to pay.
just as an old hack. If we're going to do it, it should be short. We've had the points raised. I don't think it would take long to draft. We can do it. What's the peg? I mean, we could use this meeting as a peg, actually, and just get it off very quickly. So, we're just the people representing whatever it is, $1.5 trillion, or however the dreadful long-term shareholder group justifies it. But, this group has just met the IASB and made it absolutely clear that, So, and we can either send that to the letter to the Financial Times or to Hans, or the Hans and copy in the FT, say, or do two actually, to send it to Hans and then do it exactly the same. Then, this group. But the peg is, what's the peg? Because actually, we've missed the original peg, which was the IAC statement, and we can't send the letter to the FT 2 months after that. So,
if this meeting is the peg, then at lunchtime we need the draft. Except that if we have a real newspaper deadline, maybe Jane, you should do the first draft.